Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. That war, of course, has taken on new dimensions of late with Joe Biden's decision to surrender in Afghanistan to the people that we displaced there not so long ago, the Taliban, and a host of their jihadist allies and counterparts. A man who has studied these matters closely for a long time is our first guest. His name is John Rossomondo. He is a senior analyst for defense policy at our Center for Security Policy and has, in previous incarnations, both as a journalist and as a counterterrorism analyst at the highly regarded Investigative Project on Terrorism, written extensively about, and as I say, thought thoroughly through what it means when you embolden, as I believe we are now doing, such adversaries. John Rossomondo, it's good to have you back. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio once again.
Thank you, Frank.
I wanted to start, John, with your remembrance of something that happened shortly before 9/11, and I want to talk with you about its importance to what followed. Namely, the assassination of Ahmed Shah Massoud, the Lion of the Panjshir, by al-Qaeda in the days running up to their attack against us on 9/11. Remind us who he was and his importance and why it was so consequential that he was taken out as part of the plot on 9/11.
Well, Ahmed Shah Massoud was the primary Afghan Mujahideen commander who the United States worked with going back to the Carter administration against the Soviet Union. He was a brilliant tactician, and no matter how many times the Soviets tried to invade his Panjshir Valley, his forces repulsed them. And during the 90s, they became a major antagonist of the Taliban, and the Taliban wanted him out of the way. His forces retained control of about 15% of northeastern Afghanistan. And, it was al-Qaeda wanted him to get rid of him as an insurance policy. The Taliban would protect them after the 9/11 attacks. And, some speculate that his assassination was a go-ahead for the 9/11 attacks themselves. And, after 9/11, we used his Northern Alliance forces together with CIA operatives and special forces to, kick the Taliban out. Now, thanks to Joe Biden's either malicious intent or just plain incompetence, the Taliban are back and more dangerous than ever.
Yeah, I'm with the malicious intent school myself, but the extent to which Massoud was, in fact, a check on the Taliban, his removal, I think, also had the effect of diminishing somewhat the ability of the United States to mount offensive action. Fortunately, it was overcome by the successes of our CIA and special forces operatives with the remnants of the Northern Alliance, as it's been called. But John, this brings us to the present moment. His son, also known as Ahmed Massoud, was mounting, or trying at least, to mount a new resistance to the Taliban, even after the United States withdrew, with the vice president, who was acting president, I guess, Saleh, Talk about where things stand with respect to that. I know we're going to get into this a little bit with our next guest, Sam Faddis, but give us your take on what's happening in the Panjshir Valley at the moment and the implications of it for the larger concerns we have about the Taliban and what's going to happen with Afghanistan.
Well, the Taliban, backed by Pakistani special forces, drones, and air power, overpowered the remnants of the Northern Alliance, which now calls themselves the National Front for Afghanistan, and took over the government buildings and hospitals, etc., in the Panjshir Valley. Now they've been reduced to fighting a guerrilla war, and during the 1980s, 1990s, 2000s, up until Joe Biden pulled out the support, the United States had been the source of, a major source of logistical support for these guys. Now Biden has pulled them, and Pakistan, which really controls the Taliban, is in full support. And when you have the head of the ISI showing up in Kabul, and meeting with the leaders of the Taliban, I mean, it shows where the Taliban's bread is buttered. I mean, we should have been focusing on confronting Pakistan all these years and its support for terrorism, and we might end up had a different outcome.
Indeed, the double game that the Pakistanis have played all these years and the outrage that we should feel that having our tax dollars essentially enabling the government, the intelligence services, as you say, John, the ISI, as well as the military, in their efforts to undermine our activities in Afghanistan by supporting the Taliban is one of the great, betrayals on their part, and the fact that we let them get away with it is just insane on our part. John, this brings me to the larger point that I wanted to get into with you, which is something you've also written about on the Center for Security Policy site, as well as publishing, as I recall, in 1945, one of the excellent online resources we all draw on. Talk about the damage that has been done by Biden's humiliating strategic defeat in Afghanistan to our larger counterterrorism activities and efforts.
Well, if we had kept Bagram Air Base, we would have had a base to put troops in and out in the case of emergencies or as things depended. We would have had a space for our special forces and SEALs to go in and take out our jihadist foes, plus also had a base from which we would have been able to have dealt with Russia, China, and Iran in the case of hostilities. Well, thanks to Joe Biden, when they went and launched their botched attack on an American Army translator that they lied to the world and said was an ISIS-K operative, they went and had to fly a drone from the UAE, which is over 800 miles away from the supposed target. I mean, it's absolutely disgusting. I mean, and they're trusting the Taliban to give us intelligence. What kind of incompetent fools are they?
John, what I'm interested in is, the tactical challenges is, though, again, something you've spent a lot of time and energy on over the years, is understanding the impact on the mindset, the esprit de corps, one might say, the belief in their ultimate victory that is a critical determinant of morale and, willingness to mount the jihad, that is now going to be found not just in Afghanistan and not just with respect to the Taliban, of course, but other jihadist operations, whether it's Al-Qaeda or whether it's ISIS or ISIS-K or Haqqani or others, who will find safe haven there once again. But John, you know, your thoughts on what the implications are for jihadist groups worldwide and their ability to mount attacks on us and our interests, whether overseas or perhaps even here at home.
Well, I would say that the biggest problem now of having Afghanistan is it represents a place where the American infidel was defeated, thanks to Joe Biden. And when ISIS had their safe haven, their caliphate under Obama, it was used as a launching point for propaganda that recruited jihadists in the West. You have different jihadist hotspots, in Africa, Southeast Asia, etc. Now they're going to be able to have a safe spot where they can go and train and possibly receive some of the latest weaponry, latest tactics, etc. And it's going to make the world a more dangerous place. During the Obama years, we had ISIS-inspired attacks here on American soil because of propaganda. And now we don't have the resources to go in there anymore and to take out the terrorists before they can strike. So this is an absolute disaster.
And again, beyond those considerations, and I don't disagree with anything you've said, when you look at Al-Qaeda operations in the Middle East or in the Far East, for example, whether you are looking at ISIS operations, again, in the Middle East or in Central Africa, or whether you're looking at, Hezbollah and its operations in the Middle East, yes, but also in places like Latin America. Is there any doubt in your mind, John, as a serious, student of jihadism and, the Sharia supremacism that compels it, that we're going to see these folks, whether they're training in Afghanistan or whether they're simply inspired by what went down there, vastly ramping up their jihadist activities against our friends, against our interests, and almost certainly against us as well?
There's definitely, they want to be the top dog. They believe that by their religion and ideology that, they are called by God to rule the world. And, they've viewed the United States as their, chief enemy, chief antagonist. There's no doubt in my mind that they'll work together. Iran, will provide them funding, logistical support, as they always seem to do. Now they're joined by Pakistan and Turkey in support. Down in South America, Hezbollah is very active in the narco trade, and a concern that you could have is in the case of hostilities with the Iranians, that they could use their Hezbollah sleepers in the United States to cause trouble either directly or they could support groups like Antifa or other. Europe has, and then if you move over to Europe, they have a huge problem. It doesn't get played as much in the media anymore, but you still have like knife attacks and other jihad activities. I think it's kind of interesting that every time you have a Democratic president, the jihadis get a lot more restless.
Well, if it were just restless, it would be one thing. I'm afraid they're going to be, again, both better equipped, certainly in Afghanistan, better trained, probably there, and through there elsewhere, and more, you know, confident in the ultimate triumph of their ideology and Sharia doctrine, and all of that is ominous, to say the least. Again, not just for things we care about, people we care about, countries we care about, vital interests we have, but for us here in the United States as well. John, we have to leave it at that. Thank you so much for your time today. We'll talk with you about China on another occasion soon. I think your call for surging our forces to deter the Chinese is very apt, and it's a topic to which we will be returning with you in the near future. Thank you for your time today, my friend. Keep up the good work at the Center for Security Policy, and we'll be talking with you too. John Rossomondo, folks, at CSP. Next up, we will speak with Sam Faddis about what's happening in the Panjshir and what it means for all of us, and much more right after this.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
This is Frank Gaffney with the Secure Freedom Minute. On the 20th anniversary of the 9/11 attacks, the FBI released some information long sought by survivors concerning Saudi Arabia's involvement in those murderous jihadist acts. Unredacted revelations suggest a Saudi consular official and a suspected spy helped two of the hijackers. At a moment when we both honor those killed two decades ago and have cause to worry increasingly about terrorist attacks in the offing elsewhere and here, insights into their Sharia supremacist wellspring and enablers are vitally needed. That includes U.S. government data about the help the Iranian government gave to 9/11 plotters. 5 years ago, a federal judge issued an $11 billion judgment against the regime in Tehran for its role. Before the Biden administration does any further deals with Iran, we need a full accounting of the mullah's complicity and the payments to which still grieving survivors are entitled. This is Frank Gaffney.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and very pleased, as always, to be joined by Sam Faddis, Charles Sam Faddis, a man of many, many parts and considerable and distinguished service to our country over the years, notably as an Army officer, as an undercover clandestine services officer for the Central Intelligence Agency, as an assistant attorney general in Washington State, as a congressional candidate, and as an author and essayist about matters of great import for our country, including his book, The Decline and Fall of the CIA, and his outstanding web resource, andmagazine.com. Always great to have him with us. He is a member of our Committee on the Present Danger China, among other things these days, and a great contributor to this program. We're always delighted that he's with us. Sam Faddis, welcome back.
Great to be here, as always. Thank you.
I was talking in the previous segment with my colleague at the Center for Security Policy, John Rossomondo, about something that I know you're closely monitoring as well, Sam, and that's what's happening in the Panjshir Valley in northern Afghanistan. He mentioned that the Pakistanis are helping the Taliban crush the second generation of the Northern Alliance under the son of Ahmed Massoud. Tell us what you know of what's going on there at the moment, including what seems to be a genocide on the ground there.
Well, first of all, there's absolutely no question at all that the Pakistanis, via principally the ISI, their intelligence service, have been lashed up at the Taliban for a long time, remain lashed up with them. They are in force, the ISI, on the ground in Afghanistan, and they are helping the Taliban, and they are helping them hunt down opponents of the new regime. So that's fact and well-established and really indisputable. The most recent reports out of the Panjshir Valley are that the Taliban are now rounding up all males 12 and over and taking them away. There are explanations for why, but pointedly, there is no discussion of them returning, and there are no camps to which they are being taken. So the clear intent here and the understanding of everybody in the Panjshir is that all of these people, every male 12 and over, is not coming back. And what's happening is that the Taliban is completely cleansing the Panjshir of what they regard basically, you know, a generation, maybe more, of individuals who would have any knowledge of memory of the period of American presence, because they regard them as, you know, they would be the genesis of resistance. They would be the folks that would come back to haunt them. So they're simply going to, in their terms, cleanse the Panjshir of anybody who resists them. And in the past, the way they have done this with these mass executions is they take folks away, they kill them, typically herd them into shipping containers, kill them, and then bury the shipping containers. Obviously horrifying, but they do this because they have learned from past experience, for instance, what happened in Bosnia, that the international community in the United States have the capacity to detect mass graves even remotely when you kill a whole bunch of people and bury them over a large area. So they have found a very efficient way to pack a bunch of folks in, bury them in a container, and therefore make it really hard for anybody to ever produce any evidence of what happened. This is basically what Saddam Hussein did to the Kurds in the infamous Anfal campaign. He went in and made the same cutoff, 12 and over, all males, you all die, because that's how I decapitate the resistance.
Sam, during your time in the Central Intelligence Agency, you were deployed for some extended period of time in Pakistan. You have operated against, I think it's fair to say, the ISI. You've seen what they've been doing to operate against us, for sure. Tell us just a little bit about the betrayal of this country by the people that we were paying to help us. We had to transit their country to resupply our forces in Afghanistan, so that was huge leverage over us. But how extensive was that betrayal, and to what degree do we really owe the Pakistanis for the survival of the Taliban and now their conquest of Afghanistan?
Right. Well, this again has been an ongoing dynamic, you know, forever, for as long as we've been involved in Afghanistan, with the Pakistanis sort of talking out of one side of their mouths to us and giving us a minimal level of cooperation, whatever they calculate they are required to give us at any one point in time, that has varied. And then they turn right around, that none of this impacts at all the fact that they have continued throughout our time in Afghanistan to support the Taliban, provide them with support, train them, give them safe haven. So in large measure, they are responsible for the survival of the Taliban. And they regard this clearly as a victory for this policy. And as people like Lara Logan have pointed out, we actually have had the capacity to end this game from the very beginning, right? Pakistan is a completely economically non-viable nation with a hostile neighbor, India, that would love to destroy the state of Pakistan, which they regard as a terrorist state, any day of the week. So Pakistan is not a particularly formidable adversary should we have ever decided to actually use our considerable power against them. I mean, to begin with, as I say, their economy would collapse if we wanted it to overnight. But we've never done that. We have tolerated this. And I know myself, I've had this experience, and many other agency officers had this experience of working with the Pakistanis and going, say, to round up a bunch of guys in a safe house, in other words, working against a terrorist group. And before you can get there, you find out that one of the Pakistanis you're working with made a phone call and warned the guys you were going to grab so that nobody's there by the time you get there, and we play this stupid game.
This brings me to the U.S. intelligence agency's efforts to try to induce the Pakistanis to be more helpful at the moment. Bill Burns is the director of the Central Intelligence Agency, as you know, Sam, and has, I guess, made two trips at least now to the region. What is your reading of the extent to which any improvement is now being made in this relationship? Are we simply now writing off, essentially, the prospect that we will have actual help from the Pakistanis and that they will mitigate the danger that is so clear? John and I were talking about, you certainly understand very well, from an Afghanistan ruled by their allies, the Taliban, and a safe haven being granted to fellow Sharia supremacists.
Well, I would say that the best you can expect from Burns or anybody else associated with the Biden administration is the accomplishment of absolutely nothing, right? It's meaningless. I mean, we're not exerting any pressure of any kind on anybody. What pressure are we putting on the Pakistanis? Absolutely none. Frankly, what pressure are we putting on the Taliban? Absolutely none. We're teetering on the edge on any given day, in my estimation, of releasing the $9 billion in Taliban funds, you know, in Afghan funds that are sitting abroad that the Treasury Department basically is holding. I mean, we're talking about an entire cabinet filled with people that are effectively puppets of Beijing. So the prospect that anybody...
Which is a very interested party in all of this, needless to say.
Exactly right. So the prospect that anybody is leaning on Pakistan or going to influence them is zero. I mean, nothing is happening out of any of this. That's my estimation.
In fact, it does seem as though it's worse than that. I've heard reports that after Burns visited Pakistan, the intelligence chiefs of China and Russia and Iran and maybe North Korea as well were assembled there to presumably toast the success of the Pakistanis in having their way with us and promise further support for them in doing so. It's really a scandal. Let me switch gears with you, if I can, in the remaining time we have, Sam. Your work product at End Magazine is just superb and covers a lot of ground. One other focus of particular effort of late has been the work you've been doing on the coronavirus, CCP virus, we call it around here, the Chinese Communist Party virus. What specifically Dr. Anthony Fauci appears to have done to contribute to the genesis of this pandemic, and I think it's not an exaggeration to say, to the damage it has inflicted as well. Talk about that, if you will.
Hey, well, I think it is fair to say that at this point, there are things that we know that are just matters of fact, which is that this virus clearly came out of the Wuhan lab. That is, that the Wuhan lab was conducting gain-of-function research that, by the way, the Wuhan lab, as one would suspect in communist China, has both civilian and Chinese military personnel working on biological agents there, that Anthony Fauci was funneling money to them via the EcoHealth Alliance in substantial amounts, that he knew precisely what it was for, because the written grants pursuant to which the money was transferred spelled out in excruciating detail that all of this had to do with gain-of-function research. So he knew all of that. He was involved in it. He'd been involved in it for years, so he obviously knew it from the inception. And also, I think we should add that it is clear now from emails that have come out, another thing, that from the very beginning, a whole series of very prominent virologists said, when you examine this virus, there is very, very strong, clear indication that it was in effect that what we see here are patterns of manipulation that we have only ever seen before. We've only ever seen this structure before in viruses that have been manipulated by humans. This structure does not occur in nature. We literally have never seen a naturally occurring virus that is built this way. Obviously, I'm using layman's terms. And Fauci knew that from multiple sources from very early on. So Fauci funded this. Fauci knew all of the dangers. He knew exactly who he was dealing with. And pretty much from day one, he had very strong evidence that this is not just a virus they collected and got loose on them. This is a virus they manipulated. They made this thing. He knew all that. And of course, he has lied about it over and over and over. So, you know, the catastrophic truth is we have placed at the top of our response effort to this virus the guy who, it appears, made the thing in effect, or at least contributed to making the thing, which is, of course, completely mad, but it continues to be the case to this day.
Contributed literally our tax dollars, among other things, but also contributed to the damage, Sam, it would seem, by withholding that kind of information. And by so doing, exacerbating the damage done. Is that overstating
his involvement? Without question. That is not overstating. Without question. This is a guy who that created, you know, he was involved with the creation of this entire thing and then withheld this information. And actually, beyond that, has affirmatively lied repeatedly about this. And Americans died as a consequence of this. And yet somehow
he lied, people died.
To sit there. Yeah, was literally true. And yet he continues to hold his position to this day and lecture us.
Yeah. And another example of this, Sam, as I see it, is that he also lied about the existence of therapies that could usefully be applied to minimize the damage done by this disease that he helped engineer. By that practice, he created the conditions necessary to allow the FDA to give an emergency use order for a vaccine. But he also assured that still more people died than might otherwise have done, to say nothing of, you know, perhaps accelerated a vaccine for which there are, it seems, growing concerns. No?
Well, all of that is absolutely true. And just to put a, you know, an exclamation mark on it, I guess, he has taken us down this road. He is responsible for everything you just laid out. He also has to understand that the way these vaccines are developed, the vaccine currently being marketed protects you at best, to the extent it does, and that's a whole separate subject, against the original variant of this virus, which is effectively now extinct. This vaccine does not provide immunity or protection against Delta or Mu variants or any of the variants which will inevitably continue to come. It is before we get to the health impacts and to the extent at which it was ever effective, it is a protection against a disease that does not exist anymore. That's the way to think about it. The Delta is in effect and the Mu are in effect new diseases. This vaccine does not provide immunity against them. And the only way we ever get out of this is by establishing natural immunity. That's another thing he has understood or must have understood from day one.
And there are, as I understand it, serious concerns about whether the vaccine will inhibit, if not actually preclude, people who have taken it from being able to make that natural, you know, adaptation.
That's fact. I mean, what he has done, what this entire approach has done, is guarantee that the pandemic never ends. The only way to end it is to go back to what we should have done from the beginning. Treat people as soon as they get sick. And then when they recover, they will have a natural immunity, which is much, much stronger and broader than the vaccine's immunity, and will, in fact, allow them to fight off future variants. So we are perpetuating the pandemic.
Yeah, we're going to be talking about this more with you and others in the medical community particularly. But one last thing about Fauci. It seems, according to our colleague Lawrence Sellin, that he is continuing to allow Chinese People's Liberation Army scientists, some at least associated with that biological weapons program, of which the Wuhan lab is a part, to operate inside our wire, be researchers at American laboratories, American research centers, American universities, even to this day. And it's just mind-boggling that this kind of, well, I don't know how else to describe it, but betrayal of our country is continuing and is being made possible by taxpayer funds that Tony Fauci controls. Sam, your work at End Magazine in exposing these kinds of outrages and, I hope, enabling corrective action to be taken at some point soon, is so deeply appreciated, as are your visits with us here, and I hope you will come back to us again very soon. But thank you for your time today, my friend. Godspeed. Keep up the good work.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney.
We're back, and it's always a delight to be able to say we are joined by Todd Benzman. He is one of our go-to guys, and that of, I think, most of the free world, for that matter, on matters involving immigration policy and border insecurity, of which there is a great deal at the moment, thanks to the Biden-Harris administration's policies. He is the author of a very important new report, which I'm delighted to have a chance to talk with him about. It's entitled 9/11 Plus 20, America Still Struggles to Vet Entering Foreigners for National Interest Threats. Todd is also the author of a terrific, relatively new book entitled America's Covert Border War. And he is, of course, a National Security Fellow at the outstanding Center for Immigration Studies, which published this long and very thought-provoking paper by Todd. It's good to have you with us, Todd, to have a chance to explore what you've come up with here and its implications for all of us. Welcome back.
Thanks. Thanks for having me, Frank.
This is not the first time you've raised concerns about who's getting into our country, heavens knows. You've been very closely following what's happened at our southern borders, what has been the failings under the Biden effect, as you've called it, of attracting large numbers of people here and essentially letting them all in, as best I can tell, or just about all of them. Set the stage for the more specific conversation that we want to turn to in connection with your paper, but how endemic a problem is this, and how serious are the stakes if we don't really know who's coming into this country and why?
Sure. Well, I mean, as is very well known by now, most of the 9/11 hijackers came in on visas and flew airport to airport into the United States. They, the 19 applied for 23 visas and were approved for 22 of the 23. And once they had these visas, they came and went. They entered the U.S. and left the U.S. and re-entered the U.S. at will. So there was this second layer of security that failed once they were able to get to airports in the United States. And then a third level failure of once they were in the U.S., they violated the terms of these visas. So obviously, the country had to shore up all those loopholes and improve national security vetting to make sure that people couldn't game our system. And for about 3 years after the attacks, the country invested very heavily in national security vetting for these visas to make sure that there was improved filtering, that we were checking databases, that we had better databases, that we were sharing databases, that our State Department consular officials in foreign embassies were doing counterterrorism and prioritizing that. But like anything else, you know, bad guys adapt to improvements, and they're usually quicker on the draw than we are. And so over the years of 20 years, you know, they have figured out ways to continually get visas and get into the country. Islamic terrorists are still getting into the country. And if I can just have a quick minute here, I'll tell you about my opening anecdote of the paper, which is about a guy named Naif Abdulaziz Al-Falaj, who came in on an F-2 student visa 10 years after 9/11, Saudi Arabian national, whose wife got a student visa, and he came in on the spouse of a student visa and went through the 9/11 vetting that we put in place and got into, settled in Oklahoma. Little did we know at that point that he had been an alumni of the Al-Farouq camp in Afghanistan with the 9/11 hijackers in 2000 and had given fingerprints, which had the fingerprints ever been run, would have showed that he that they matched to 15 fingerprints found by the military in 2001 on his application form to get into the Al-Farouq camp. So he's able to live, walk free throughout the United States for 5 years before the FBI figured out that he was an Al-Farouq camp veteran with the 9/11 hijackers. How did they find that out? Well, he applied for pilot training in Oklahoma, the same area, that 20 minutes from the pilot school that two of the 9/11 hijackers attended to take the flights. And they ran his fingerprints and found those matches. Finally, the FBI rolls this guy up. It turns out that he was just as committed to jihad today as he was then. He was in communication with jihadists in Chechnya and in Afghanistan, looking to rejoin the fight and to go violent in his jihadism. And we got rid of him. We put him in 12 years in prison, only in 2018. So this is fairly recent, this kind of thing. And there are many, many cases like this, Frank, and it's not just Islamic terrorists either.
So this is the point. It's not an abstraction or a hypothetical problem. This is a real world ticking time bomb, if I can use that expression, probably literally in the sense of some of these guys. And when you document this, Todd Bensman, what do people you deal with? I mean, for a time, you were yourself in the Texas Department of Public Safety for a time, you know, as an intelligence analyst. What do people you have as excellent contacts and sources say in response to concerns about this ongoing problem with, well, jihadists to some extent, and perhaps other terrorists as well, not being properly vetted, that is?
Well, it seemed to me when I was in service, through 2018, from 2009 to 2018, that there was always this surprise that these guys kept getting in. We had in Texas an F-1 visa holder who was with one chemical precursor of having an operable bomb out of Lubbock, Texas. He came very close to conducting attacks with that bomb. Nobody knew. Another Saudi who got in on a student visa. And that was in 2011. This is years after 9/11. And there are, in 2009, which was the last time that the Homeland Security Enterprise really took this seriously, was when the Nigerian, we call him the underwear bomber now, managed to get a hold of a tourist visa, despite the fact that for 3 years he was consorting with Anwar al-Awlaki and had been fully radicalized, and managed to get a tourist visa and fly his underwear bomb over Detroit. Thank God it malfunctioned. But we went through this other period of, because that was so publicly known, Congress held hearings and the White House did this and that, and we had improvements again and investment in visa security and integrity at that point. But it's just continued for years. I've got probably about almost 60 cases of visa, national security visa vetting failure just in the last 10 or 12 years. And it's not just Islamic terrorists. There are a lot of other kinds of problems. For example, Chinese spies have been getting in. We've been arresting them in the last 2 years, who have been coming in on the J and F visas to join our premier research institutions for defense research and stealing all our best stuff and shipping it back to the Chinese Communist Party. Once you look at the cases that have been filed against them, the federal cases, you can see that these people just said, I've never been a member of the Chinese military, when a simple Google search would have turned up their faces in full Chinese regalia, military regalia. Like, the failures are epic. In not just terrorism, but in espionage. So the point of the
then on top of all of that, you have the more run of the mill cartels and narco traffickers and human traffickers and other criminals, rapists and, you know, gang members and the like. And presumably, you know, that is just a further example of an intensifying danger to public safety and public health, for that matter, in this country, as a result of lax borders and inadequate attention to who the people are who are getting in. But let me turn quickly to Afghanistan, because by some counts, we've seen the Biden-Harris administration bring in tens and tens and tens of thousands of Afghan nationals into the United States, many of them now deposited at U.S. military bases. And it's my understanding that a considerable number of them may not even have identification papers, let alone have been properly vetted, as you say, evaluated for the potential danger that they may pose to this country. Is that correct? Give us a sense of the magnitude of this and again, of the implications.
That's right. Well, from what we know today about what happened just in the last 3 or 4 weeks is that Afghans who managed to get past the gate at Kabul airport talked their way onto the planes. That was the extent of it. If you had a young Marine standing guard there and you could show a piece of paper that looked kind of like you had worked for the Americans and, you know, you could talk your way onto the plane, and a whole lot of them talked their way into the evacuation flights. And no small number, I think about 111 last count, had passports. They were in possession of passports that didn't belong to them. They were stolen passports. So we have no idea who those people are. There were other people who were making claims about working for the Americans that, you know, are not verifiable and are probably lies, because you'll say anything to get on one of those planes and get to America and get to live here. And so we have a big job ahead of us to try to figure out whether these people are who they claim they were, whether they're eligible for special immigrant visas or any other kind of visa. And the big problem, as you know, Frank, is that you can't run a name against a classified database that doesn't include that name. So not everybody's in our classified databases. So what are you going to check it against? This is rural Afghanistan. We don't know who half of these people are. But I can tell you that, you know, I wrote a piece published on, I want to say on Friday, about an Afghan doctor who got in about 10 years ago, who had massive ties to a terrorist organization. He was dead. This is in a non-crisis period when things were normal before the fall of Kabul. And he managed to get in and hide the fact that he was involved in a terrorist organization that was killing American troops the entire time. He was treating their fighters as a doctor, and that visa system failed in his case. The FBI finally picked him up a couple of years ago and convicted him of visa fraud and deported him, but not before he had been communicating with books, sending back and forth books with coded messages between the pages for years inside the United States, doing God knows what else. And this was right here in I want to say it was in Philadelphia is where that happened.
So let's just get to sort of what do we do about this. First of all, Todd, if we find that individuals who have gotten into this country through this extraction program of Joe Biden's, how much latitude do we have if we determine that they should not be here to deport them?
What they'll do is, because they're in U.S. custody and care, they have full constitutional protections and access to appeals systems. They can stay here for years and years appealing. And in any case, we as a nation never designated a place to deport the ones that are ineligible based on terrorism. And in fact, the continuing resolution that's up today in Congress, the Biden administration slipped in provisions that allow the DHS secretary to override the terrorism exclusion. Whenever they need to override the terrorism exclusion and let them stay, ordinarily it's by, we have to deport if they are connected to terrorism, except that if this thing passes, it'll give them their out. And we didn't designate any. We don't know where we're going to deport these people. We're probably going to let them go and hope that the FBI catches them later.
They're certainly not going to be sending them to Guantanamo Bay, are they? Because the president seems determined to shut that place down. But this is really
stunning. The problem is that this
stunning.
Has become, you know, national security vetting has become partisan because the prior president, Donald Trump, made it one of his top issues. He called it extreme vetting. You could call it whatever you want, but it's, I call it just better and improved and constantly evolving vetting, because that's what's necessary. And I will say that he, by presidential proclamation, established something called the National Vetting Center. The Biden administration so far has left the National Vetting Center alone. I've been in touch with some of the people over there, and it looks like they may not kill that. National Vetting Center. There is a lot of goodness that can come from the continued evolution of the National Vetting Center. It's there, it's operating, but it's fetal and needs to a lot of care, attention, and investment to get online with the refugees and the Afghans.
This is a key point.
They're not ready yet for the Afghans, but they could be.
This is a key point, Todd, and it's a capability that we have, at least in its infancy, and should be building upon. But it doesn't alter the fact that we've let people in that we are going to have a very hard time removing, even if they're terrorists, if this continuing resolution is allowed to get through. And the problem, as you say, is that, we may not know who they are, and even if we do know who they are, we may not have them in classified databases that would prompt flags to be thrown on them. So this is a hugely important topic. We appreciate, as always, your diligence in reporting on it, Todd, as well as your clear-eyed warnings as to why we have to get our hands around this, or it is entirely possible that we will find ourselves confronting here threats that we have been hoping to confine to distant lands. And it will be the height of, betrayal if we've wound up importing them.
Well, I was going to say at this point, things are so far gone, Frank, in my opinion, that we now have to rely on the FBI's Joint Terrorism Task Forces and their field offices around the country to clean up whatever mess we've made. And I hope that they catch them. But I don't think it's possible that we'll have terror attacks here from Afghanis. I think it's very probable.
Todd, thank you again for what you do at the Center for Immigration Studies, a terrific outfit. CIS.org is where you can find much information about Todd and his team. You can also see their terrific webinars. Come back to us again soon if you would, Todd. I hope the rest of you will do the same again tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Afty. Thanks for listening.